You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
Have an old car taking up space? Donate it to KBOO. Your unused vehicle can become music to our ears, powering independent radio that amplifies diverse voices and community perspectives. It's easy and hassle-free. Either visit kboo.fm/cars or call 1-877-KBOO-123. You'll get a tax deduction and the satisfaction of supporting local independent media. Donate your car to KBOO Community Radio today and drive change in your community.
From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to Indigenous in the News. I'm your host, Larry Kay from the Ho-Chunk Nation, along with Gary Wilcox from the Powhatan Nation. Joining us today is Shannon O'Loughlin, a citizen of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma and a chief executive for the Association on American Indian Affairs. With decades of experience in tribal law, Shannon leads the nation's oldest nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting sovereignty, preserving culture, and advancing the rights of Indigenous communities. Today, we'll hear about the history and the programs they provide, along with information on their 10th annual repatriation conference, Igniting Change, February 15th. From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to Indigenous in the News. I'm your host, Larry Kay, and joining me is Gary Wilcox. Today, our guest comes to us from Clarksville, Maryland. She is the chief executive and attorney for the Association on American Indian Affairs.
Hello, Shannon, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Gary. It's great to be here.
Hi, Shannon. How are you doing today? Great to have you on the show as well.
I'm doing pretty good, Larry. Thanks for having us, having the Association on American Indian Affairs join you today.
Yes. I'm happy to have you on the show today and learn all about the association and the great service that they provide for our people. Can you tell us about the journey as a citizen of the Choctaw Nation and how it led you to your role as chief executive of the Association of American Indian Affairs?
I sure can. How much time you got?
We got lots of time.
Well, so I was adopted and raised by my grandparents, thank goodness. Roseanne, my grandmother, raised me and would take me all around southeastern Oklahoma, especially to our lands that were just kind of right up from the Red River, right in the southeastern corner of Oklahoma. And she would show where there were old homesteads and graveyards. And she would point out our ancestors. And I think that was the first thing that kind of drove me to connect and want to protect our histories. Little did I know that one day I would actually go to law school.
Wow.
I was raised in Oklahoma. I never knew a lawyer, thank God. And it was kind of a joke that I would go to law school. I had a friend of mine, we'll call him Lumby Larry.
Right.
And Lumby Larry was gonna go to law school. He was studying this big blue book. And I said, "What are you doing, Larry?" And he said, "I'm studying for the LSAT." And I said, "What's that for?" He's like, "Well, it's an entrance exam you have to take in order to get into law school." And I said, "Well, if a Lumbee can go to law school, then certainly a Choctaw can go to law school." And so I kind of followed Larry around and took that LSAT exam and ended up at the University of Arizona College of Law. Had wonderful professors like James Anaya, who's well known in Indigenous peoples' human rights work, and Robert Williams, a junior, who's a prolific legal scholar, and really had great mentorship, and then worked for, I've worked for 25 years now as an attorney and few other things. But I came into a specific practice on repatriation and protecting cultural heritage because I had a job working with the traditional nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy.
Okay.
And it was there that they said, you know, we can never be whole. They told me we can never be whole unless our ancestors are brought home and, and put back to peace, right?
Yeah.
And to journey forward. And you're going to do that for us. We've been trying and trying for a century to get our ancestors home, and we haven't been successful. So use that law of yours and get our ancestors home. So that was really my first work into understanding this law called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. And I really built up a specialty in that practice and have been involved in it in all sorts of ways since that early time as an attorney for the Haudenosaunee Confederacy.
What progress has been made today, and what challenges remain?
In NAGPRA,
yeah,
specifically?
NAGPRA.
Yeah, there's so recently, in January 2024, there were brand new regulations implemented for the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Prior to then, like 33 years of practice in NAGPRA, the museums had all the control. And they were leveraging their power to really burden Native country and not returning items. Now, that's not everybody. There were some institutions that have done wonderful work and developed wonderful relationships with Native nations. But there are a few, especially those big academic institutions like Berkeley and Harvard, and some others like the Field Museum, that have just been defiantly opposed to NAGPRA or have created a lot of burdens for tribes to establish before they can get anything back. So those regulations were meant to clarify what Congress intended about NAGPRA. So the regulations prior to this didn't even define consultation, right? How do you know how to work with tribes? How do you know how to repatriate unless you're talking to the primary experts of Native culture? Right, which are those affiliated Native nations. So the regulations clearly and wonderfully defined what consultation requires. It's also the first piece of policy and law that specifically cites to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples now. So there's a provision in the NAGPRA regulations that requires free, prior and informed consent for an institution to do anything with their Native collections, right? Because Congress declared that institutions don't have a right of possession to our heritage and to our ancestors' bodies. And so this helps, you know, clarify to the institutions that these are not yours, right? You need permission to do anything with these collections and repatriate, right? So a lot of really strong changes were made by these new regulations. And so we're undertaking a lot of training to make sure that the field and the practice of repatriation across the US is being done correctly now. So we're doing a lot of training.
I just recently had, we just had a demonstration recently with the Miccosukee people on an issue about exactly this that you're talking about, and they were not able, we kept asking them, can you define what is, you know, what is funerary and what is non-funerary, and how can you come up with that understanding, you know, to the city when you don't even know what you have, and you know, You know, you're, it doesn't come from your people. So how can you say what is non-funerary and what is funerary? How does your organization look at that?
The law is really clear about that, and it's not the institution's job to define what's funerary. It's actually Native nations, and these new regulations have clarified that definitions and what falls under a category of what is a funerary object. The institution must give deference to the native nation for their definition of what falls under that category. Mm-hmm. So it's not the institution's responsibility. They are supposed to simply defer to native nations' understanding of it, because it's the Miccosukee who are the experts of their
Absolutely.
Own culture, right? Not the institution.
Yep.
And the regulations are absolutely clear. And so what I would recommend to the Miccosukee people and their nation is to reach out to the National NAGPRA program and get some technical support and assistance. Or they could also come to our 10th annual repatriation conference, where we're doing comprehensive training on the new NAGPRA regulations. So we'll have professionals and experts that are going to take on that training for folks.
Sure.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, because we have, you know, billionaires that are art, you know, they're art collectors, and they're looking for these things to just, you know, put on display, and they need to be repatriated to, you know, where they came from. You know, look, build your whatever you're gonna build, but just put them back in the dirt. Leave it there. Don't disturb it. You know, and they don't seem to understand. It's the whole, they want now, the question is, oh, we want to honor the tribe. Well, you know, we prefer that you just leave it there. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And, but anyway, thank you so much for that answer. Can you share a story about a successful repatriation effort that illustrates the impact of this work on tribal communities?
There are so many wonderful stories, and some of them are simple, right? Some of them are simple. The institution does what they're supposed to do, and ancestors get to go home. I've heard stories where repatriation practitioners and spiritual leaders and institutions come together for reburials. I'm not being real specific right now, because I don't have consent to share. So for this story, there was this wonderful spiritual leader, and the individual she was reburying was a child. And so the ceremony and the event that happened to put that child back in the ground was extremely emotional for everyone involved, and created space for healing and understanding with that institution, right, that had held that ancestor. So it was a healing opportunity, not just for our relatives, our native nations, but also for those institutions to experience that and really understand what our ancestors mean to us and how they're connected to us today. But some of the more maybe prolific stories in repatriation, for example, there's this wonderful resource called the NAGPRA Comic Book Series.
Oh, wow.
And if you Google it, you can find it pretty easily online. There's a story in there about an attempted repatriation between Michigan Nations and Harvard Peabody Museum. And Harvard Peabody basically labeled all of these ancestors as culturally unidentifiable. And this was based on the old regulations that didn't work well, right? Because if Harvard would have actually consulted like they're supposed to do, those ancestors would not have been unidentifiable, because they had geographic information that connected them with their origin nations. So that meant that the tribes had to come up. They had the burden of proving those were their ancestors. And so they had stacks and stacks of research that they provided to Harvard Peabody, and still Harvard Peabody rejected their claim for repatriation. and stated the only way we'll repatriate is if you go through the disposition process. Again, these are the old regulations. The disposition process required the tribes to actually go to the NAGPRA review committee to get permission from the Secretary of Interior to allow the repatriation to occur. So this is how burdensome Harvard Peabody was making this repatriation, even though there was evidence to support repatriation. And the reason that the Harvard Peabody wanted to do that is because they wanted to hold on to the associated funerary objects, because the previous regulations allowed an institution to keep those if it was under this kind of secondary disposition process. So they just wanted to keep those funerary objects. And so the association worked really hard on those regulation changes. And we also did a lot of advocacy to share with Native Country about what Harvard's practices were. What Harvard ended up doing after all of that is agreeing to return those funerary objects. But I have to tell you, the hard part of the story is that all of those nations had to recreate all of those funerary objects in order to return their ancestors to the graves to begin with. And so think about what that meant for those tribes who are now getting the original funerary objects back much later, and having to disinter so they can reinter, the kind of burdens that institutions gave to Native nations because they wanted to hold items that didn't belong to them.
Right.
It's still a legacy now. And so we hope that these new regulations are going to correct for those bad actors. That was really the need as we were trying to shift the behavior of some of these bad actors and kind of slap them on the head with clear black and white statements about what they had to do to repatriate instead of them really controlling the field. So there's beautiful stories out there, and there's also stories that of increased burden and suffering that the institutions have laid on Native nations.
Today, our guest is Shannon O'Loughlin, Chief Executive for the Association on American Indian Affairs. We're learning about the history and the programs they provide, and their 10th annual Repatriation Conference, Igniting Change, February 15th. Find out all about them on the web at indian-affairs.org.
What are the current priorities of the association, the AAIA, and why are these issues particularly urgent right now?
So the association has a huge portfolio of issues that we work on. We're not nearly big enough to really tackle all the issues that need to be tackled. And so we also partner with other organizations to help build capacity with Native nations and among the advocacy that's happening in Native Country. We have three kind of big overarching program areas that hold all of our work. One is our Become an Ally program, which is really our public education arm. Everything we do, we work to educate the public and uplift the public's understanding of what's happening in Native country. Our Next Generations program is our program that covers all our children, family, and health issues. So, for example, that's where our ICWA work lies. That's where our youth justice, our juvenile justice work lies. That's where we have scholarships. We're the oldest giver of Native undergrad and grad scholarships. We've been doing that since
Nice.
1947. We give funding to
Wow.
Native-led summer camps. And support those summer camps in the summertime, we think are so important, just to reinvigorate our youth and culture and getting outside and reconnecting with elders and community. Our cultural sovereignty program area is our third, and that covers all the things that make us who we are as Native people. So that's it. You can imagine all the issues that are under there. So that's our repatriation of sacred places, federal acknowledgement and identity, protecting lands and waters, our ecosystem relationships. That's where all of those programs are.
The association has been advocating for Indian rights for over 100 years now. How has the organization mission evolved over time?
So, the Association on American Indian Affairs is in our 103rd
Nice.
year
Yes.
of advocacy. We began in 1922. The organization had a different name then. And so we've been through a few name changes. We've been through a few collective amalgamations of other Native nonprofits into the association. And for, the first several decades, we were the only game in town, the only national Native nonprofit working on these issues. The organization helped to set up the National Congress of American Indians. It was the inspiration for the National Indian Child Welfare Association and for the Native American Rights Fund. So the association has a strong legacy of really creating watershed legislation such as the Indian Child Welfare Act, the Indian Reorganization Act, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Of course, we look back on some of these today and go, well, those are a little antiquated, but yeah, it was the 1930s, right? So, of course, it was a little antiquated, and we look at things differently now. But the association helped to set the stage for self-determination and sovereignty during a time when all there was assimilation and genocide, right? So, I can't imagine what it would be like to be a leader back then when sovereignty and self-determination weren't really at all a part of U.S. policy and Indian affairs. Today it is, and we face different struggles. And so, unfortunately, with every change of political administrations, Native country has to re-educate all of these new leaders about who Native nations are and what sovereignty means to us and what issues need to be addressed. We don't quite know what's coming in this next administration, but I think we can guess on a few things. One area that the association has been pretty strong on, and I think we're going to need to get stronger about, is protecting sacred places, protecting places where we do ceremony, places where we've buried our ancestors, and other important areas. I think those are going to be open for attack in the next administration that we're worried about.
Tell us about the association's 10th annual repatriation conference, Igniting Change. It's coming up soon, right?
It's coming up real soon. February 25th, 26th, and 27th.
Yeah.
The Tunica Biloxi Tribe is hosting us at their Paragon Resort. And let me tell you, they got the best Brussels sprouts and they got the best bread pudding there. I don't know that either one of them are traditional, but they're damn good.
Mm-hmm.
The conference is going to be there in February, and it's going to spend a lot of time on hands-on training on the new NAGPRA regulations.
Good deal.
Native practitioners, Native representatives, and tribal leadership can attend for free. So anyone who's Native working for their nation can register and attend the conference in person for free. We'll also be talking about international repatriation and how we get our ancestors and cultural items back from institutions all around the world. We'll also be talking about the Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony Act, which was passed in December 22, I believe. It was signed by President Biden. The proposed regulations were recently published, and we'll be talking about how that law helps to protect our cultural heritage from being exported out to other countries, and also has a voluntary return provision for folks like dealers and collectors, instead of being charged with a potential civil or criminal penalty, they can voluntarily return items.
Nice.
So that's another good law we're going to be talking about there. We've got great keynote speakers. We're going to be working on issues of intergenerational healing and providing some training there. Abigail Echohawk is one of our keynote speakers.
Nice.
She's wonderful. So is Chip Caldwell, who's non-native, and has been a positive museum professional supporting repatriation, who will also be our keynote.
Nice, awesome. Nice. I'm
Can
excited.
Anyone become a member? And where do we go if we want to join your organization?
You can learn more about the Association on American Indian Affairs at indian-affairs.org. If you go to the events tab, that's where you can find our repatriation conference and learn more about what we do all over Native country.
Great.
Can anyone be a member there, or do you have to be with a specific tribe?
So we are a membership organization. We don't accept federal funds, so all of our funding is from public private sources, mm-hmm. and not the federal government. So anyone can be a member. You do not have to be a Native person. And so that's what I think makes the association so strong. We're not just a Native organization.
Absolutely.
But we have a full Native board. Anyone who agrees with our vision, mission, goals can participate and be a part of our family.
Oh,
nice. Shannon, thank you for visiting us today and giving us an update on everything you do and the great, great challenges you face.
Well, Yakoki, Larry, thank you for this wonderful space, and I really appreciate spending time with you today.
Yes, we'll have you back on soon again.
It was a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous in the News and supporting us and our entrepreneurs. Indigenous in the News has been produced by Larry Kay. Our engineer is Paul Salvatore. Our theme music is composed by Lenny Long. Today's show has been recorded at the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida. Come visit us at indigenousmusicandarts.org to hear all of our past shows and learn all about the great programs that we provide. Until next time, from all of us here at Indigenous in the News, have yourself a great week and safe journeys. Music today was from Pura Fay, River People. Indigenous in the News is a production of Indigenous in Music and Art.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to Indigenous in the News. I'm your host, Larry Kay from the Ho-Chunk Nation, along with Gary Wilcox from the Powhatan Nation. On today's show, we're thrilled to welcome Dallas Arcan, joining us from Edmonton, Alberta. Dallas is a three-time world champion, hoop dancer, teacher, and mentor who's dedicated to inspiring others through his artistry and knowledge. Today, we'll dive into his incredible journey, explore his many achievements, and hear all about the upcoming release of his new book this summer, 13 Hoops, Life's Lessons Lived and Learned.
From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to another edition of Indigenous in the News. I'm your host, Gary Wilcox. Joining me today is Larry Kay. How's it going today, Larry?
I'm doing well down here in Florida. How are you doing, Gary?
I'm doing great. It's chilly.
All right. Today, our guest is coming all the way from Edmonton, Alberta. His career spans for more than 30 years, and he's here to share his story and tell us about his upcoming release of his new book, 13 Hoops, Life's Lessons Lived and Learned.
Hi, Dallas. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Dallas.
Hey, guys.
How you doing today?
Good. How about yourselves?
Doing well.
Very good.
Great to have you on the show. Welcome. Why don't we start with an introduction?
All right. Well, hello, everybody out there in TV and radio land.
Yeah.
We're all, I guess, nowadays, social media land and all the all the virtual landscapes out there. And
nice.
It's great to be Indigenous this day and age, you know, because we can shine on all these platforms and we have a lot more resources and tools. And that's what I love about social media is a lot of our young people are coming up in a big way to showcase in many different formats, everything from fashion, music, television, creative stuff like funny videos and, you know, very creative videos. There's a lot of TikTok stars and social media stars out there nowadays. And I feel like I got left behind by all those young guys. But I'm still going. I'm still keeping on my path. That's all I can say. So thank you guys for having me on your radio show today. It's a great honor and a privilege. And I thank you guys so much for having me here today.
Right on.
So Dallas, tell us about your new book, 13 Hoops, Life's Lessons Lived and Learned.
Yeah, well, here's my new book here, 13 Hoops, Life's Lessons Lived and Learned. So it's an Indigenous contemporary interpretation of the world through the lens of a world champion hoop dancer. So what I share in this book is a combined 30 years of experience of things that I've learned in my life.
Nice.
And nice. I definitely incorporate a lot of our oral tradition because as many of you know that our culture, in our Indigenous culture, oral tradition is how we pass on the knowledge and how the knowledge is passed on from generation to generation and how our knowledge is actually survived through on colonialization and assimilation. And, you know, our culture is still here today because of the oral storytelling. So I felt it was very important to put in the book. So each chapter actually has a QR code that prompts you. All you got to do is scan over it. And you can go to the oral part of the chapter in which I share some knowledge. So the reason why I call it 13 Hoops is because I use 13 Hoops. It's one of the main hoop dance routines that I do. And part of the reason why is because an elder brought it to my attention when I was composing the routine. I was trying to make something that was more significant and connected to our culture. And so back in those times when I was younger, I thought about in our Cree language, we have names for every month. So I made very, very much sense for me to make the hoop dance routine alongside the months, because every new month, I remember in our language, it means something different. It's a different time of the year. You know, like right now is the winter months, right? So we have those winter moons. And then it was brought to my attention that our people never followed the linear calendar. The elders told me that our people followed the moon cycle and that every year we have 13 moons that circulate the earth. And that was our traditional way of counting the months.
Hey.
and a way of living in harmony with the land and Mother Earth and Grandmother Moon. So that's how that came about, and that's why I named my book after it, 13 hooks, in honor of that 13 moon cycle.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what that represents, and that's why I named it that way. And then the book is very reflective of that. So I have 13 chapters in the book. So each chapter, I share it just like how our ancestors, I try to keep it in line with our ancestral knowledge. Not that I know a lot about it, but I'm definitely an aspiring knowledge keeper and storyteller myself. So I felt that it was important to perpetuate that message and put that message out there and use those images and that sacred put forth into the 21st century and beyond, and just to keep our culture going and going strong. Now, one of the reasons why I did this book in the first place is when I started this journey as a hoop dancer, as an artist, I remember back in my college days, I was hungry for knowledge, and I didn't really find a lot of books in the library on our people, by our people. So I figured this is part of my legacy to leave for the next generation, for my children and my grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And speaking of which, I do have grandchildren. I know, like the typical grandpa, yeah. But I do have, I'm a Mutchum in the Cree language. That means grandpa. So oh, yeah. I have three, I'm proud to say I have three grandchildren. I'm very blessed. And that's for them. That's for their generation and beyond. And so our culture survives and thrives. Future. So that's part of the reason why I did this book. So that's what that book's all about there.
All right.
Was there a lot of planning put into the book?
Oh yeah, there was a lot of trial and error. There's a lot of planning. Mm-hmm. I've been picking away at it for the past 5 years.
Wow.
You know, I made attempts at it, you know, and it's
sure.
It's like when you're writing a book, it's like you look at it like it's Mount Everest. Like, how the hell am I going to climb up there? You know, how the hell am I going to do that? It's impossible.
Wow.
And then you just kind of inch away at it. You make a plan. You aspire to do it. You say you want to do it. You manifest it and you work towards it. So every little inch counts all along the way. Like this first edition that I'm showing you here, this is only the prototype. So this is only about 20,000 words.
Gotcha.
That will be done actually tomorrow. It's actually in final editing right now. The current word count right now for the final book, the final product, is 75,000 words.
All right. Wow.
So it's going to be a very resourceful tool for teachers and knowledge keepers in the future. And that's just my best effort into my contribution, not only as a hoop dancer and an artist, but also now as an author. I felt it was my duty to do that. So I had to basically rewrite this book about, I'd say about 5 or 6 times before I got it right. So it was a long process. It was a lot of work.
Can you tell us about what drew you to being a hoop dancer? Like, how did you get involved in that? How'd that come about?
It was an accidental discovery for me because I grew up in Edmonton, and I grew up half on reserve and half in the city. So sometimes I'd be living on the res and sometimes I'd be in the city. But all the while I was always around my own people, my indigenous side of my family. And that's all I ever known growing up. And nobody in my family did any dancing at the time. And I didn't know of powwows. I'd never been to a powwow until I was like maybe about 13 or 14 years old. And I wasn't as connected as I wanted to be maybe. And I didn't know anything about it. You know, I had my Indian status card and that's all I knew is res life and res life, watching the aunties play bingo and you know, all the stuff that goes with it. I didn't see much culture. And that's partially what residential schools took away from my generation and my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation. That's kind of where it all started. And so how I got it was attending an all-Indigenous school in Edmonton called the Ben Calfrobe School. And while I was going to that school, I had a friend that was in my class, and we would hang out every day. His name was Joe Chatsis. He was from Saskatchewan. He was another Cree he was more full than me. Like, I'm a mixed breed. Like, he's, but anyways, one day I went to Joe's place after school, and you know, like after school buddies hang out, and so I was hanging out at Joe's place, and all of a sudden I noticed there's a big pile of hoops on. First thing I did is I was like, hey man, what are these for? Are these for hula hooping? And you know, me being the class clown that I am, I kind of was making fun of it, and he's like, no, that's not for hula hooping, we don't do no hula hooping here. And then he's like, it's hoop dance. And then okay, well, what's hoop dance? I have no idea what hoop dancing is. And then so poof, he showed me, and it was like this new magic trick to me. It was like, I was so fascinated and just inspired right on the spot there. And he showed me a video of him dancing in a video and doing his hoop dance. And eventually I went to his performances and I seen him do it for real. And it just uplifted my spirit. I just felt like it ripped the spirit out of my body and sort of like showed me who I am right there. And so Joe showed me a couple of moves to start out with. And so for about a year or two, I was in the closet hoop dancer, because I had no intention of performing and being a hoop dancer. I just loved to, I thought it was cool to do these tricks, like to make yourself into an eagle, or to flop it around and make it into a flower shape, or or make all these shapes. Nice. And so I thought it was just so cool. So that's how I kind of got into it, and eventually after a year or two of practicing, it was the encouragement of my family, because they seen that I was doing something other than getting in trouble with the law and you know, getting in trouble at school or whatever. They noticed I had a talent for it, and they noticed that you know, it kept me out of trouble. So they encouraged me to do that. And that's kind of how I got into it. And I'm grateful for it, because, you know, in a way it actually saved my life, because a lot of people, you know, the statistics, I don't know how the statistics are in the United States, but in Canada, they're really high for Indigenous men ending up in jail or in gangs or on the streets or, you know, into heavy drugs and stuff like that. So, in a way, it brought me closer to the culture, and I'm grateful for that. So that's, in a way, the hoop dancing, it really saved my life. So I thank the Creator for that gift, and it's given me so much in my life, and I'm grateful for it.
Good story.
Dallas, can you tell us about DJ Crazy Cree, and can you talk a little bit more about how you got into electronic music and how the mix inspired, and how you inspired the mix into traditional elements as well, indigenous elements?
Okay, yeah, that's an easy one. I'm sure a lot of you guys have heard of, and DJ Shub, and well, there's Boogie the Beat. There's so many, but because of technology, though, we've been able to do that. Because I remember back in the day, back like way before social media or even I was spinning records. I was a DJ. You know, and because I'm also into hip-hop culture, because hip-hop culture, if you ever look into what hip-hop culture is, it's not just Black people or Hispanic people. Was a culture from that came from oppressed people. I guess it originated in New York. But there's like a cesspool of many different cultures there of poor people. So the original version of hip hop kind of a voice in a way, and it gave the people a platform. And there's everything from DJing, MCing, breakdancing, graffiti, and you know, there's many different elements of hip hop. So that's why a lot of our young people relate to hip hop music. That's how I related to. Like, one of my favorite rappers back in the day was, you know, Young MC, all the way from Young MC to Tupac to Digital Underground to Ice-T, and you know, and so on and so forth. There's so many great rappers out there. Hip hop is, you know, like an organic way of sharing a voice from the grassroots level of people, and basically everything from pop culture to you know, also like what's going on in the hood, and in a way it's our voice as people. So how I got into it is I've also wrote my own hip hop music. I've rapped. You know, I am a rapper. I can rap. I
nice.
I got the chops. You know, ever since I was a kid, I was into music. Like back in the res, I remember the adults. They would always pull out guitars and sing all night, and they would play the spoons and. You know, that was they used to party, but it was fun times. You know, it wasn't always bad times, and I remember that was one of the good things that came out of watching or being around the adults when they're having their little parties or their little fiestas, that's one thing. Music, I was always fascinated by guitar and all kinds of music, singing. So that's kind of how I got into it. It was just part of my culture in a way, and that's how I was brought into it. I was cultured into it. And back in the day, I used to make mixtapes and DJ. I was just playing music, like mixing music. I would play one record over here, a CD here, and then I used to put a tape on record and I would mix my tracks. And then I would just give away the tapes to people, or else I would just play it in my. Back in the days, used to have a tape player and have one on repeat. So I've been doing DJing since way back in the day. So I figured when Tribe Called Red came out with their own version, I figured my version. So I collaborated with my cousin and a couple of friends and a couple of people that I knew that did traditional songs. Because when I started... The cultural element of things. I started out as a drummer and a singer, but I'm not such a good in the cultural songs. So that's why I ended up being a better dancer than a singer. So, but I still wanted to participate in the music. So that's why I decided to produce my own DJ Crazy Cree album in Future Generations. That was the first album that I did.
Good album.
It turned out pretty good. Hey, it was something that I just put together just off of what I know and some visions and some experimenting with the music, and it actually won a music award, and I'm very grateful for that. And you know, before the pandemic, I was actually scheduled to go on tour all across the Eastern Seaboard, all the way from Canada all the way down to Florida, but the pandemic kind of killed my career as a DJ. And so that's how I just kind of put it aside for now. But I plan on releasing some new material. I sent Larry a new track that I've been holding on to for a while. And it's a good track because it kind of interprets some of the language. And that's, for me, that's the most important part of the music is sharing some of the culture and language.
What is today's song about?
Today's song is Naka Cha. So that's, it's another slang word in the Cree language. It means like holy or real deadly, kind of means.
Right on.
It's just kind of a, you know, like we have a couple of slang words that we say in Cree, like we say wah-wah is like holy, like and naka cha is like naka cha. Sometimes you'll hear those powwow announcers, they'll say that, when they're, especially up north in our powwow circuit here in the summer, you'll hear, naka cha, that guy's a good dancer, wah, wah, you know, like that's kind of like our way.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the song that you're going to hear that I sent you, it's interpreted in English, and it's interpreted in Cree and English, so he goes back and forth. That's my cousin, actually, Stan Arcan Jr., that's the song composer.
Nice, nice.
What I did is I recorded him, and then we did the music to what he did, and we recorded the track to a metronome. So that's how we're able to use Western instruments to line it up so that it fits in that realm.
Cool, cool. Today we're speaking with Dallas Arcan. He's a three-time world champion hoop dancer, teacher, and mentor. We're learning about his journey along with the upcoming release of his new book this summer, 13 Hoops, Life's Lessons Lived and Learned. You can read all about Dellis and get a hold of him on his homepage at dellisarcan.ca. Here is the new music release from Dellis. Here is Nukacha.
It looks good that you're dancing here. It's very good that we've come again to have fun. You've come once again to powwow, and it is very beautiful that you are here to dance. It looks good that you're dancing. Pichikista makuta. We have come here to have fun, and this is very good. Asaminak pipuat simwik. You are here to powwow again. Miwasin takan mitwik. It's very good that you are here to dance. Pretty much what it means. We have come here to have fun, and this is very good.
Nice.
Wow. Are you also the creator of Powwow and the Dance, right, Aerobics?
Yeah, I do a program called Powwow Dance Aerobics. Yeah. I just started again here in the beginning of the new year. I decided to get started on that again. And I originally started that back in the pandemic when everybody had to stay home.
Mm-hmm.
I was happy about it at first because, being an artist, I was always traveling. I was always living out of a suitcase. And then finally, everything just kind of came to a halt. And then I was like, oh, okay, well, I don't mind. Staying home is like a vacation. And then after 2 months of it, I was getting a little stir crazy. And I was like, oh, man.
a lot of dancing.
Yeah. So I would do that on my own. But like I always practice and work out on my own. But I figure, why don't I share this with people and educate people and help our people get healthy? Like not just the business people, but it was a platform that I designed to invite others in too to learn, because there's a lot of people that are curious about indigenous culture, powwow, want to learn about dancing, they want to be connected, right?
Right.
Absolutely.
How has the audience responded? What are they saying? They like it? I know I like it.
Yeah. A lot of the audience that participated in it, there's people young and old. A lot of the elderly folks, they always tell me that it helps them, even though they have issues. Like some people have, they're struggling with their health. Like recently somebody shared that they have an autoimmune disease and they have fibromyalgia and all kinds of stuff, but they still try to do my Powwow Dance Aerobics program because, it helps them. Any little bit of effort that we make to improve our health and to exercise and to work out, it helps. And that's part of my message with my program is, like as we know, and a lot of other Indigenous people across North America know that we have a lot of health issues in our communities, everything from diabetes to like cancer to addictions problems to, obesity and so on and so forth. Program encourages, though, it's one little defense mechanism or one little mechanism that you can use, one tool that you can use to fight against all that. It's better than nothing. So it's a start to something, and that's what I make my platform. It's a friendly version of taking a proactive approach to your health and also to getting healthy.
Right on. Today we're speaking with Dallas Arcan, hoop dancer, mentor, and musician. What advice do you have for young Indigenous artists and performers getting into the scene?
Well, believe in yourself and follow your dreams and follow your passion far in life, because, you know, like, it all starts with you out there. So just believe in yourself and keep going and keep growing and mm-hmm. and just keep investing yourself. The best investment you can ever make in life is in yourself. And so by doing that, you can grow into many things in life. And so just believe in yourself and make your dreams come true and keep manifesting those things that you want in life, and they will happen. And it takes consistency, because the first step to 1,000 miles is taking that first single step. Mm-hmm. And eventually you will get there, because the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step.
Salute. Good words.
Dallas, where can we find your book, and what is the best way to get a hold of you?
Well, I do have a website, dallasarcan.ca. I believe I sent you the link, mm-hmm. and it's poster. So you can Google me, Dallas Arcan. And there's actually two Dallas Arcans out there, because I have a son, yeah. Dallas Arcan Jr.
All right.
And I'm proud to say that my son does exactly what I do as well, but even better. He's the browner, handsomer version of me. He's the browner of me. Uh-huh. And he's the one who's blessing me with all my grandchildren. He has three children now, and those are where all my grandchildren are. And I'm very proud of my son and my daughter, because I believe that I've helped to break the cycle in the next generation, because I've done all I can as a father and a provider to make a better life for my children. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's one of my greatest accomplishments in life.
Good job. Mm-hmm.
Dallas, it was a pleasure having you with us today. I learned a lot about you, and thank you for all the great things that you do for our communities. Thank you so much.
Right on.
Thank you, Gary.
Yeah, thank you for stopping by and giving our listening audience a chance to meet you, and it's a pleasure to have you on today's show. So thank you, Dallas. Stop by again.
Thanks, Larry.
Yeah. Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous in the News and supporting us and our entrepreneurs. Indigenous in the News has been produced by Larry Kay. Our engineer is Paul Salvatore. Our theme music is composed by Lenny Long. Today's show has been recorded at the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida. Come visit us at indigenousinmusicandarts.org to hear all of our past shows and learn all about the great programs that we provide. Until next time, from all of us here at Indigenous in the News, have yourself a wonderful week and safe journeys. Indigenous in the News is a production of Indigenous in Music and Art.
This is KBOO Portland.
It seems like recently the struggle to take action on climate change has gotten more complicated. And there are a lot of solutions that are presented to us that at first glance look kind of good, because they have the words green or